Hey everyone, my name is Eunice.
And I'm Michelle.
And I'm Mauro.
And we're here with Native Questions, a podcast to discuss contemporary issues relevant to Indigenous youth. So today we have a question for you, and the question is, why would someone cold-heartedly kill a 16-year-old?
No one really knows for sure why anyone would do that, but it has happened more often than a lot of people think, and do you know of any specific cases where that's happened, Eunice?
I do, actually. So this particular case is a story of a mother named Pauline Mitchell, and she had a 16-year-old son, and he had gone to a rodeo in the June of 2001, so it's summertime in Colorado, and he never came home that night.
So when did they find him?
So they found him after 5 days. So if you can imagine Pauline being distraught for 5 days and worried about her son's well-being. They had found him brutally disfigured and beaten to death and left in a canyon, so.
And did they find out who did it?
Actually, they did. So that night at the party, Fred Martinez had actually met an 18-year-old named Sean Murphy, and they had gone to a party after the rodeo. And the details are actually unclear, but later Sean Murphy agreed to second-degree murder and also was sentenced to 40 years in jail. And he was quoted to have said, "I beat up a fag."
That's really sad that it was taken that far. I have heard about Fred Martinez, but I didn't know that his murder was that brutal. He was a two-spirit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that means that his body simultaneously housed a masculine and a feminine spirit.
That's right.
That's what his community and he believed. And that term is specific to Native North American and Canadian groups. And it usually refers to someone who's anatomically male, but that's not always the case.
That's really interesting. So you had mentioned the concept of spirit?
Yes.
That's really interesting just because the concept of spirit is generally not associated with gender. Especially because this fluid understanding of having a masculine spirit and a feminine spirit is probably difficult to understand in a Western social context that constructs gender in a strict binary, so you're either a male or you're a female, and then society probably expects you to be strictly heterosexual. So anyone who challenges those binaries then becomes non-normative, just like Fred Martinez.
Yeah, I can only imagine how his mom felt.
Yeah, that's really observant of you, Michelle. His mom actually did have a statement during the trial, and she says, "My son Fred Martinez, as he was known by family and friends, left this world much too soon because of those who fear and hate anyone who is different."
Yeah, personally, growing up in a Western culture, thinking about gender in terms of spirit is kind of obscure to me, but a lot of people in the Indigenous communities have thought about gender this way for a long time, hundreds of years, and think about gender a lot more fluidly than Western culture does.
How so?
Before colonial influence, most tribes associated certain tasks as being a man or a woman's role, but oftentimes they would cross over. So men would do tasks that were associated with a woman's role without having their sexuality questioned.
Yeah, and that's probably not the case today, because if someone partakes in an activity normally associated with the opposite sex, then their sexuality becomes automatically in question. So in the case of Fred Martinez, he was known to wear makeup around high school and bring a purse to school, so he was actually a target of bullying.
Yeah, it's really sad that two spirits like Fred Martinez face the persecution that they do today, because before colonialism, they were widely accepted in their communities and even had special roles during some ceremonies.
I feel like this is a good segue point for us to start talking about our interview with Dr. Finley. So the next things you'll hear are some of the questions that we asked Dr. Finley about indigenous issues relating to our topic. So could you tell us a little bit more about your work, Dr. Finley?
So, yeah, my thing is more about, like, kind of evaluating representations of Indigenous people and, you know, and also, like how, you know, Indigenous people, you know, take those representations and change them into something else, and also, like, how we've internalized those ideas, too. So, So that's kind of more of like the work that I do. But for my tribe, we don't have like a two-spirit situation. But what's interesting about that is that we have recently adopted a gay marriage into our tribe, which is really surprising to me because, you know, like, you know, most people on my reservation that I know are really, you know, pretty homophobic, you know, because that's one of the ways that colonization has really affected us in a negative way.
Can you elaborate
way.
A little bit more on what you were saying about the representations of Indigenous people? Like, how are Indigenous people like represented, and what is what you see in like the media and these representations?
Obviously, most of the images we see of Indigenous people are of us like in the past, or like you know, like especially for women in terms of like, you know, Sacagawea and like Pocahontas or other like trader figures, you know, are like the prominent representations of Indigenous people. Most of my students, when I ask them about like when they think about representations of Indigenous people, they always cite the film, the cartoon Pocahontas. Because the other thing is too, is that that's actually what, you know, Indigenous kids are exposed to also. And I used to love that shit, right? I was like, you know, I was so happy when there was Indians, you know, like when I heard the, you know, the drums, you know, come in and I knew that the Indians are going to come and invade the settlers. I was like, yes, you know, and I didn't see really the problem of being represented as a bloodthirsty savage, you know, but I also knew that I was never on the winning side of things too. So I feel like those things really take a toll on us as a people, because all we usually see are negative stereotypes.
What are some misconceptions that you see people having about Indigenous communities?
We exist in the modern world or whatever, right? So it's not like we get to be, you know, beyond that somehow or whatever. And that's one of the other things I think it's important to disrupt. And I don't hear you all like saying this or whatever, but just the idea that, you know, Indigenous people are better with sexuality and better with gender stuff because often we're not, you know, like traditional practices can be for sure, but I'm really interested in practices that, like are actually that we're inventing for ourselves now, you know?
What are some of the effects of colonialism that you like see affecting different communities and the existence of like different practices, even like hindering their development?
Just like with the murdered and missing Indigenous women, you know, like the fact that we are obviously so murderable, that takes a toll on me as a person. Like I can't, you know, because it's obvious that like my presence here can be eliminated and nothing is going to happen or nothing's going to change, you know, so. So those are, I think, you know, in a lot of ways we ended up, you know, dealing with that stuff is like through like, you know, drug addiction and all these other problems that, you know, colonization has wrought within, you know, our lives and our families and our communities, and things that unfortunately we have passed on, you know, we've been passing on to the next generation.
That brings us to the topic of colonialism, and actually the United States has a long, violent history of settler colonialism on Indigenous lands, and I actually recently took a class that touched briefly on Native American boarding schools, and it talked about how just the horrifying ways that the school functioned to effectively enact cultural genocide by killing the Indian and saving the man. So actually there are a lot of cases of sexual, physical, emotional, and mental abuse that the young natives had to endure. And in summary, this was kind of a conglomeration of the efforts of missionaries and government agencies and boarding schools and white settlers. And all in all, it caused the loss of many traditions in Native communities.
And one of those experiences being two-spirit roles, because the term two-spirit is relatively new, and it's kind of an umbrella term used to describe Native third genders. And there are actually 150 documented tribes that have some sort of variation of two-spirit gender. And the term came about in the early 1990s as an alternative to Western labels like homosexual, gay, and transsexual. but there are so many different terms to describe third and even fourth genders, such as the Navajo Nahdle.
Womack?
I've heard of it, but I haven't read the whole thing. I heard it's a really good specific account of a young Native man trying to understand his sexuality and struggling within the context of his culture.
Right, so Drowning in Fire is actually a story about a young man named Josh, and he grew up in the indigenous community, also influenced by the Christian tradition, so he was grown up being taught that homosexuality was wrong, but he wrestled with his attraction to other boys as a child, and it's a deeply personal account where he hears stories from his great aunt growing up, and it's really beautifully written, so I can imagine how it can be a powerful way for Native youth to connect to this story and people who are going through similar things.
Yeah, it sounds like Josh from Drowning in Fire and Fred Martinez are really important examples of challenges that a lot of people face today in relation to sexuality within Native communities. And I think colonialism has presented a lot of new challenges for those in Native communities who don't fit into the strict binary gender categories that Western society has constructed.
So far, we've been discussing the Two-Spirit concept in Indigenous communities, but I think it's important to emphasize that having multiple or nuanced gender identities is not unique to Indigenous communities, and it's actually been documented globally throughout the world. So, you know how you mentioned how each Indigenous community will have different understandings of the third gender role?
Yeah.
I think if we expand that to the global scope, third gender roles become even more varied. So I'm thinking about how the society probably has stereotypical expectations placed upon third gender people, and I'm wondering if you know any specific examples, Michelle, of what it's like to kind of constantly swim against the current.
I do. I actually know about a pretty large transgendered community in Indonesia called the Waria, and they get that term from the words Wanita, which means woman, and Priya, which means man. And they're typically in their community seen as sex workers on the side of the road at night and wearing miniskirts, often as drag queens and on TV.
Is that how they view themselves, though?
Actually, the Waria community is very diverse. It includes men who identify very closely as women, so much so that they embody that every day, and others who only dress up on occasion and wear makeup sometimes, but they're actually very diverse. And one Waria that I read about actually quoted how they feel about themselves by saying, "In the end, only a Waria knows what it means to be a Waria. We have to define ourselves." And there's actually a documentary about them which talks about three individuals who identify as Waria and their search for romantic relationships and the struggles that they face in their community, how they have to leave their lovers often because society expects them to marry women and have children.
Wow, that must be really painful.
Yeah, definitely. Do you know of any other communities that face similar struggles, Eunice?
Yeah, actually that reminds me of a documentary called Kumuhina, and it's about the struggles of a Native Hawaiian woman named Kumuhina, and she is identified as a mahu, or a transgender woman, and actually her role in society is very celebrated and honored and respected. She's a kumu, or a teacher, and she teaches students and youth hula dancing, and also, as she does so, also teaches them cultural practices and traditions and values. So throughout the course of the documentary, she tells us about how, unlike a lot of other transgender people, she's really fortunate to have found love in a committed relationship with a man.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how third genders are celebrated differently in different parts of the world. For example, the Muxas in Oaxaca, Mexico, they're part of the Zapotec indigenous community. And there, they're accepted, and it's understood that there are men, women, and Muxas in that area. So the Muxas are born men, raised as women, and then they live their whole life as women.
Yeah, and just to add off of that note about how celebrated they are, there's actually a celebration in November called the Vigil of the Authentic Intrepid Searchers of Danger. It takes place in the city of Juchitán, Oaxaca, in Mexico, and it basically is an all-day festivity event to celebrate the ways that the Muses are a part of the community. And they're largely known to be entertainers and performers and people who are really engaging and just really celebrated members of society.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Unfortunately, a lot of the groups that we've discussed today are not as celebrated as the Muxes in Oaxaca. Most of them face stereotyping, discrimination, violence, abuse, and even hatred.
Yeah, and if we just think about the first story that we talked about with Fred Martinez and how his murder left his family in shambles, and or about if we think about the Waria folks who desire to be in romantic relationships but are left abandoned because of their position in society as anatomically male, it's just really painful to think about the spectrum of human experience.
And there's definitely a lot of pain involved in the lives of those that are affected by violence.
I agree, but I think there's also a certain sense of somber hope and beauty in the way that Fred Martinez's life and death pretty much served as a painful catalyst for nationwide awareness of the issue of violence against queer Indigenous folks. So we hope by talking about this subject that we can help usher you into a position of celebration with queer Indigenous folks and also a greater desire to foster personal allyship.
As we close off, we'd like to leave you with the last question that we asked Dr. Finley, which was, what is your message that you would want to send to Indigenous youth, since that is our target audience?
Well, I always think of I think of Fred Moten's work, because this is like the thing I always tell my students is the only thing I want you to learn, and this is from any class I teach, is about there's nothing wrong with you. Like, you don't need to be corrected. You know, like that very idea. And I think, you know, being like, I know when I was young and, you know, there was always this idea that there was something very wrong with how I looked, who I was. You know, because like you're this native person and you're not supposed to actually exist, right? But then you do. And there's something really abnormal about that. And so I think that would be like my main message that I would like to say.